com.
It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station. We're broadcasting from up here on Signal Hill, where it is 36 degrees. They're calling for a 50% chance of snow showers for the rest of the day. Mostly cloudy skies with a high near 37. South winds to 10. For tonight, snow showers are likely mainly between 1 and 4 a.m. Mostly cloudy skies tonight, too, with a low around 29. Southeast winds to 10 are expected to turn to the southwest after midnight. Coming up on the Midday Report, Alaska's Labor Commissioner, Dr. Tamika Ledbetter, will be in attendance for Confish. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth had a conversation with her. And Alaska's sole seat for the U.S. House is vacant. There will be two special elections this summer to fill the remainder of his term. Also, a Dillingham resident is recovering in a Seattle hospital after a snow machine crash that left him injured in a remote creek bed on Sunday.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Amy Held. Madeleine Albright, the first woman to serve as Secretary of State, has died. She was 85. The cause was cancer. As a girl, she fled persecution in Czechoslovakia and came to the U.S., where, as NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports, she's being remembered today as a champion of democracy and human rights.
Born in 1937 in Prague, her father was a member of the Czechoslovak Foreign Service. Following a communist coup, her family immigrated to the United States, where Albright went on to earn a PhD at Columbia University. After a brief stint on Capitol Hill, she worked as a staff member in the Jimmy Carter administration and on the National Security Council. In 1993, she was appointed by President Clinton to ambassador to the United Nations. 3 years later, she made history after Clinton appointed her to Secretary of State, becoming the highest-ranking woman in government at the time. She promoted the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons and eastward expansion of NATO. She pushed for military intervention during the humanitarian crisis in Kosovo and was a fierce advocate for human rights. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News.
President Biden is arriving in Europe 1 month into Russia's invasion of Ukraine. He will discuss next steps with NATO allies in Brussels, as his administration today formally accused Russia's armed forces of committing war crimes. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Washington is promising to track atrocities for future trials.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he carefully reviewed U.S. intelligence and public information about Russia's attacks before reaching the assessment that, quote, Russia's forces have committed war crimes in Ukraine. His point person on the matter, Beth Van Skok, says it's important to shine a light on this.
It's also extremely important to continue to document what's happening on the ground, to preserve that information as potential evidence for future accountability purposes.
She says Russia has bombed apartment buildings, schools, hospitals, and critical infrastructure in its, quote, unprovoked war of choice in Ukraine. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Today's Supreme Court confirmation hearing for Ketanji Brown Jackson is expected to wrap up in the next few hours. NPR's Domenico Montanaro has the latest.
Judge Jackson has shown herself to be calm and careful and likely did enough to convince Democrats to stick together and vote for her. And that's what's most important here as far as confirmation goes, because Democrats narrowly control the Senate and she only needs 51 votes to be confirmed. The White House is holding out hope that some Republicans could cross over and vote for Jackson, but those most likely won't come from Republican members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Many of them were more interested in airing grievances and scoring political points, particularly on crime and how racism is taught in schools. Those are areas Republicans have focused on against Democratic candidates in this election year. Domenico Montanaro, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow closed down 448 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
This week, Alaska's Labor Commissioner, Dr. Kamika Ledbetter, will be in attendance for ComFish. That's the commercial fishing trade show held annually in downtown Kodiak. Ledbetter moved to Alaska in 2003 when she was stationed at Elmendorf Air Force Base. She served as the regional manager for the Anchorage-Matsu Economic Region, and in 2018 she was appointed as Commissioner of Alaska's Department of Labor and Workforce Development by Governor Mike Dunleavy. This will be the first time Ledbetter has been to ComFish. KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth spoke with her ahead of her trip to the island.
Nationwide, we've seen high rates of unemployment at the start of the pandemic. Since then, many have returned to work, but maybe moved to a different employer or industry. And at the same time, we've seen these pretty high rates of worker shortages. How has that played out in Alaska, and where are we right now?
You know, it's been very interesting. The pandemic has presented lots of opportunities to dig a little deeper into what really is going on. I believe it exposed a lot of things that were probably problematic to begin with. We had an aging workforce. We had individuals who were looking at probably doing something different, but weren't sure of if now was the time to sit out. We have young people who aren't getting into the workforce as quickly as we would like them to, because they're not sure what they want to do. And so we had quite a few issues that I think the pandemic exacerbated, but it also gives us an opportunity to look to the future. I think our future is bright. I think the worker has changed in that they have an opportunity to now reimagine what their work will be. And perhaps if you were a grocery worker, or you were, let's say, a teller at a bank and you're deciding, I want to do something different. Maybe I want to go back to school, receive some more training, get into a new industry. This really is a good time to take advantage of those opportunities now.
And speaking of the future, of course, I need to ask about the $1 trillion infrastructure bill that was signed by President Biden last fall. And the president also just signed a $1.5 trillion spending package this month. There's a lot of money coming to Alaska through both of those bills. How are we going to find the workers for some of these really much needed projects in the state?
That's a great question, and we are having lots of conversation about that right now. I know that the governor has proposed $10 million specifically to the Department of Labor to be administered through the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. What I will say, federal funding is not new to the department. We have lots of funding streams that we utilize to bolster and to strengthen the workforce. I know there's a lot of talk about the money that is coming in, but I think a better conversation is how can we upskill workers? How can we create pathways for new opportunities? How can we bring individuals who are on the sidelines into the workforce? How can we challenge young people to understand that there's more than one path to success? Maybe you're not going to a four-year college, but you know what? A trade may be the path that you're going to take to be successful. And whatever it is, I would encourage individuals to reach out to our department, because there's so much that we have to offer.
And you mentioned the Workforce Investment Board. I was actually going to ask you that. Governor Dunleavy's proposed budget includes $10 million allocated to your department through that board. Can you talk about that, and particularly how it might impact remote and rural areas of the state?
We're looking at bolstering the partnership that AvTech, which is a division of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. That partnership with the university system, they received a designation from the U.S. Department of Transportation for the Domestic Center for Maritime Excellence. So we would like to put a portion of those funds toward that to bolster those trainings that are Coast Guard related trainings for communities, coastal communities. We are also looking at supporting rural residents with individual training accounts. And that funding is essentially directed by the customer. They decide what training they want to go to, and the department then supports that training with funding. And then also the bulk of it, we are looking at putting out out to on the street, we call it, where individual training entities can go through the competitive process, like the STEP process, to be awarded funding for training. The department itself does not do the training, but we support, we partner with entities that do a very good job of skilling up Alaskans, training local workers for local communities and those opportunities that exist in those communities.
And of course, you are coming here for Comfish in Kodiak. Have you been to Comfish before?
This is absolutely my first time, and I'm so excited to visit Kodiak. It's my first time in Kodiak, actually. So I'm looking forward to it, and I can't wait to be boots on the ground to do some visits and to see what the island has to offer. And I'm just looking forward to meeting all of the great people who live there.
That was Alaska's Labor Commissioner, Dr. Tamika Ledbetter, talking with KMXT's Kirsten Dobroth. Ledbetter will be in Kodiak for Comfish, which starts tomorrow. Alaska's sole seat in the U.S. House of Representatives is vacant following the death of Representative Don Young. There will be two special elections this summer to fill the remainder of his term, a special primary election on June 11th and a special election to pick the winner on August 16th. Complicating things a bit is the fact that August 16th is also Alaska's regular primary election day. State Division of Elections Director Gail Fanumiai says holding two elections at once allows the state to avoid another separate election date.
The main concern is having this special primary election timely enough to get it certified so the race can appear on the August 16th primary election, so we would not be forced with doing yet another special election.
Governor Mike Dunleavy said at a news conference yesterday that he would soon issue a proclamation setting the election dates. Lieutenant Governor Kevin Meyer says that since the June 11th special primary is coming up so quickly, he decided to hold the election by mail.
The vote by mail option just is pretty much the only way we can go and still make a, still have a successful primary special election.
Voters will still have the option of voting in person at regional Division of Elections offices early or on the special election day. But most polling places will be closed that day. The deadline for candidates to file to fill the vacancy is April 1st. The special election will be the first conducted under the state's new ranked choice voting system. It starts with an open pick one primary. So voters will select one candidate in the special primary, which will be open to candidates from all political parties. The four candidates who get the most votes in the primary will advance to the final special election ballot where voters will rank them. Young's seat will remain vacant until September 2nd, the scheduled date for certifying the special election results. Whoever wins the special election will hold that seat until early January, when the winner of the November election will be sworn in for a full term. The same person could win both elections and just stay in office. A Dillingham resident is recovering in a Seattle hospital after a snow machine crash that left him injured on a remote creek bed on Sunday night. As KDLG's Izzy Ross reports, a pilot, a visiting firefighter, and local snow machiners worked together to rescue 33-year-old Caleb Westfall.
It wasn't the first time Courtney Horozdovsky had gotten a call from the International Rescue Coordination Center. She says her brother, Caleb Westfall, had used his InReach satellite messenger to call for help when he got caught in a sudden storm while fishing last June. On Sunday, he pressed the SOS button again. Horozdovsky says her brother had also sent a one-word message, crash.
So I was like, oh boy, here we go. he's not on a boat this time, but, I didn't know what he was up to out there. I figured he was snow machining.
Westfall was at the top of the Iowithla River in the McClung Hills, about 50 miles north of Dillingham. Horozdovsky says her brother had crashed after hitting a creek bed and seemed to be in rough shape.
He was texting another friend from his InReach the whole time, just kind of one-word answers, things like serious injury, that kind of thing. So it was a little concerning because he was, you know, just one word answers and it sounded pretty bad. He thought he had broken his femur.
Horzdovsky got in contact with some of Westfall's friends, and the rescue center contacted the state troopers shortly before 5 p.m. on Sunday. Troopers requested help from local rescue teams and sent for a helicopter from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, located in Anchorage, more than 300 miles away. But volunteers got there first. Ian Foe was one of the first to arrive on the scene. He often goes out snow machining with Westfall. He got a call from Westfall's sister and the troopers Sunday afternoon.
I automatically just started getting dressed and was in contact with the trooper, and he was going to contact some people and let me know what the plan was.
He rallied three friends, and they set out for the crash site on snow machines. Foe's group found Westfall conscious but badly bleeding from his leg and face when they reached him shortly before 8 p.m.
We just kept him warm. We brought some blankets, and we started a small fire and waited for the helicopter. It was going to be on its way. But we also contacted a friend in the area that was flying around, and he's on skis.
That friend was pilot Gabe Davis. He says one of the snow machiners told him Westfall had activated an SOS signal.
He told me about where he was. I know the trail, so I went over and tried to find his trail, and I found it, and I saw him, and he had damaged his snow machine. I mean, I could see blood on the snow, and he was in pretty rough shape.
Davis had to fly to Dillingham and unload his plane so it was light enough to get back to the scene.
By stroke of luck, the guy I was with, who's a friend of mine who came up for vacation to see Alaska, is a fireman
and a first responder.
When we got back to Dillingham, we had some lumber, and so we grabbed some sheets of plywood and some 2x4s to make a backboard and stuff. So we took off, went back and landed, and by the time we got there the second time, the snow machiners were there.
The group of snow machiners told Davis a trooper helicopter was on its way from Anchorage, but 3 hours after the accident was first reported, it hadn't arrived yet. Davis didn't think they should wait.
I said, F*** that. We're putting him in the airplane and getting him out of here. It was after 8 o'clock at night.
The volunteer rescuers fashioned a makeshift plywood gurney and loaded Westfall into Davis's plane. Westfall was flown to Dillingham, then medevaced to Seattle. His sister says he has multiple broken bones in his face, bruised lungs, and a gash on his leg, but he's in stable condition.
He's awake. He's texting. He's in good spirits. He told me he looks worse than he feels, so that's good. And we're just really thankful that it ended up this way.
Foe says that over the several hours they were out there, it felt like everything was a matter of life and death. He says a few strokes of good fortune made all the difference.
I think it was extremely important that the airplane was there. He happened to be in the area, and he happened to be working on a project himself, so he had adequate supplies on the plane, including a first aid kit, as well as a friend who is a firefighter EMT, so that was a huge help. The fact that he had supplies on his plane for us to make a gurney to transport Caleb about 300 yards to the plane.
But luck only goes so far. Foe says the rescue wouldn't have been possible without quick thinking from everyone involved.
Also, just add how proud I am about the community of skilled outdoorsmen in this area, and makes me feel just really grateful and confident in the people in this community that have the skills and the wherewithal and just the decision making at the time, in the moment. It gives me so much confidence in the people in this community.
He says they came together with their skills and experience to save Westfall's life. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
State biologists are looking into how a recent oil spill around 15 miles northwest of Sitka will affect the Sack Row herring fishery, which went on 2-hour notice yesterday morning. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game's annual preseason herring meeting on Monday night was punctuated by news of the spill, which occurred early that morning when a tugboat towing an Alaska Marine Lines barge ran aground in Neva Strait. In the collision, one of the tugboat's fuel tanks ruptured. The size of the oil spill remains unknown, but the boat has an overall fuel capacity of about 45,000 gallons, and the ruptured forward tank can hold about 13,000 gallons. Sarah Moore is a spokesperson for the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. She says as of Monday evening, response teams were still working to remove fuel from the damaged fuel tank and had successfully patched all of the holes in the tugboat's hull.
One of the big to-do items for the next couple of days is to remove the tow line from the barge so that the barge can continue on to Sitka, and then they will continue to focus on recovering the tugboat that is grounded.
Sitka Area Management Biologist Aaron Dupuy said Fish and Game began assessing the impact on the fishery on Tuesday morning.
Nets will not go in the water until we have a good handle on where the diesel spill is. Nobody wants to get oiled nets or oiled fish or any of that. So in our aerial survey and with vessel surveys, we'll be able to know exactly where the sheen is, and the commercial fishery will not operate in areas that are impacted by this.
Fisheries biologist Troy Tedinko added that the state has a zero-tolerance policy for oil contamination and seafood, and they would not open an area for fishing if there was a risk of contamination. Dupuy said that as of Monday, the visible sheen had not extended into Olga Strait or into Krestoff Sound, where the herring openers have occurred in the past. As long as the sheen remains limited to Neva Strait, Dupuy didn't anticipate it would impact the timing of the fishery.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
Insight Daily Radio. Becoming Steve Jobs, the evolution of a reckless upstart into a visionary leader, is the recently released number one New York Times bestseller about the iconic founder of Apple. We spoke with co-authors Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli about their insightful new book.
He was very reckless as a young man, as a lot of us are. He was impulsive, and so he would go charging into things or make sudden decisions that he was absolutely confident about, where he hadn't even really thought about it all that much. Now, he was instinctively intelligent, and he had a certain kind of street smarts that applied well to being a businessman, and especially a high-tech businessman, but he was reckless in that he would try things and then change his mind and dart off in another direction, and he expected everybody to go along with him and just accept his zigging and zagging.
Steve was reckless as a young man in the sense that he couldn't reconcile his technological dreams and Apple's corporate needs. He always preferred to go for the breakthrough and be bold when, in fact, computing has moments of great boldness and amazing breakthroughs. But the industry as a whole moves ahead in incremental steps. And he was not interested in the incremental at all.
That's co-authors Brent Schlender and Rick Tetzeli on their newly released book, Becoming Steve Jobs, The Evolution of a Reckless Upstart into a Visionary Leader. Insight Daily Radio.
The COVID-19 pandemic has created unexpected financial hardship for many Alaskans. Do you need help paying your mortgage? You're not alone. Now there's help. If you own a home, you may be eligible for Alaska Housing Homeowner Relief. The program may help cover mortgage payments, property taxes, utilities, insurance premiums, and homeowner association dues. The last day to apply is Monday, April 4th. Learn more and sign up at alaskahousingrelief.org. That's alaskahousingrelief.org.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 23rd day of March, the year 2022. The sun rose today at 8:02. It will set again at 8:31. That will give us 12 hours and 29 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 5 minutes compared to yesterday. Our record high for this date was 55 degrees, set in 1965, and a record low was 4 degrees set in chilly, chilly 1975. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up in just a few minutes here on the east side. That will happen at 12:33 p.m. and be minus 2/10 of a foot. Our next high tide will be at 6:54 p.m. and be a 6-foot tide. Our low tide for around midnight will happen at 12:09 a.m. and be a 2.6-foot tide. And our high tide for tomorrow morning here on the east side will happen at 6:33 a.m. and be a 9-foot tide. Over on the west side, you have a low tide coming up at 12:56 p.m., almost 1 p.m. That will be a minus 4/10 of a foot tide in Larsen Bay. Your next high tide will be at 7:15 p.m., an 11-foot tide. Your low tide for after midnight will be at 12:43 a.m., a 4-foot tide. And your high tide for tomorrow morning in Larsen Bay will happen at 7:01 a.m. and be 13.7 feet. Mariners, we have a small craft advisory for today and Thursday for Kodiak's east side, Marmot Island to Sitkanek. For today, southwest 20, seas to 8 feet. For tonight, south 15, seas to 6 feet. And for tomorrow, northwest 25, except northeast 30, north of Dangerous Cape, seas to 9 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, we have a gale warning today. Northwest 25 in the Shelikof, except northeast 35 over the northern strait. Seas 8 feet, should come down to 5 feet this afternoon. Freezing spray in the Shelikof today. For tomorrow, look for northeast winds to 15, becoming north 30 tomorrow afternoon. Seas building to 10 feet tomorrow afternoon. And for tomorrow night in the Shelikof, northeast 25, seas to 9 feet. The Solid Waste Advisory Board will be having their regular meeting. That's happening at 5:15 p.m. tonight in the Assembly Chambers. Tomorrow, March 24th, the Kodiak Island Borough School Board will be having their joint work session, the Borough Assembly and the School Board. That's happening at 6:30 p.m. in the School District Conference Room. That's F-140 in the old wing. Agenda items include a budget discussion for the 2023 fiscal year, facilities maintenance update, holdover monies, renewal and replacement priorities, facilities expenditures, and a budget submission deadline. The Kodiak City Council will hold a regular meeting tomorrow. That's happening at 7:30 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library. It's open to the public, and public members are also encouraged to tune in right here on KMXT at 100.1 FM. The meeting will also be web-streamed, and that link, as well as meeting packets, are available at the City of Kodiak website. If you have any questions, contact the clerk at 486-8636. Five cooperative members will be candidates for 3 3-year seats for the KEA Board of Directors this year. Mark Anderson, Linda Freed, Megan Kelly, Matthew Moyer, and David Odell all filed their completed candidate petition packets successfully. The annual membership meeting, annual report, and ballot will be mailed to members of KEA on Thursday, March 31st. Voted ballots must be returned in the postage-paid envelopes by Friday, April 22nd. All voting will be done by mail. Ballot results will be announced at KEA's 80th annual membership meeting on Monday, April 25th. The meeting will be held at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium and begin at 7 p.m. on April 25th. And remember, the signed postage paid return envelopes will be entered into prize drawings at the annual membership meeting. The prizes are two $250 certificates for electricity. The Board of Education meeting scheduled for last Monday has been rescheduled for next Monday, March 28th. It's happening at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room. That's F-140 of the old high school wing. If you have any questions, contact Bianca Clark at 907-486-7566. Have you heard about the new asphalt art project happening downtown? If you have you thought, I'd like to be involved in that project team and give feedback to it? If so, join the Asphalt Art Initiatives Focus Group. The first meeting is Tuesday, March 29th, next Tuesday, from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Kodiak Public Library. There are a limited number of spaces available for this focus group, so please RSVP to Lynn Walker, who's the project coordinator. You can find her at curator@kodiakhistorymuseum.org or give her a call at 907-486-5917.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Hello, Kodiak. It's time for Bunker Bluegrass.
Well, I've been all around my old hometown. I've searched everywhere I know, but I can't find a trace of my girl in this place, so there's nothing to do but go. I'll be riding that midnight train when it's leaving and I'm going away to stay. Always wanted to know where the engine did go, gonna go where it goes today. Oh, she said she'd be true till the fighting was through, said she'd wait for me till the end. But she's proven untrue and her sweet love is true, so I'm catching that train again. I'll be riding that midnight train when it's leaving and I'm going away to stay. Always wanted to know where that engine did go, gonna go where it goes today. Well, I've seen that old train pulling out in the rain, seen it leave with the stars up above. Like a hound on the trail, it carries the mail, it will take me away from that love. I'll be riding that midnight train when it's leaving, and I'm going away to stay. Always wanted to know where the engine did go, gonna go where it goes today. Always wanted to know where the engine did go, gonna go where it goes today.
That was Jim and Jesse with The Midnight Train. I've got the Osborne Brothers, Joe Maphis, Betty Jean Robinson, Mac Wiseman, the